you all for standing by. I'd like to remind the participants that their lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until today's question-and-answer session. At that time, if you do have questions, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Star 2 will take the question out of queue. Today's conference is being recorded. If there's any objections, please disconnect. I will be turning the call to your first speaker for today, Barbara Reynolds. You may begin.
Thank you, Kelly. And everyone, welcome to CDC's daily update on the first Ebola case diagnosed in the United States. We'll be hearing from three speakers and then immediately go to questions. We'll be asking that reporters take, we do just one question and a follow-up. And before I introduce our first speaker from CDC, I just wanted to note that Dr. Tom Frieden, the CDC director, was planning to be on the call, but he is at a meeting with national business leaders about the Ebola response, and he'll be back with us tomorrow and Sunday. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Beth Bell, who is the director of CDC's National Center for Emerging and Zoonotic Infectious Diseases. Dr. Bell.
Good afternoon. As Barbara mentioned, CDC will be holding these media briefings daily to share updates and to answer your questions on the response to the first case of Ebola to be diagnosed in the United States. We recognize that even a single case of Ebola in the United States seems threatening, but the simple truth is that we do know how to stop Ebola spread between people. I know that many of you are very, very interested in the Dallas investigation, and I thought I would just make a few comments focusing on what CDC is doing before we turn over to our colleagues in Texas to talk about some of the specifics of the current situation. So CDC has 10 disease control experts on the ground who have been working with our state and local colleagues. We have been working with the hospital to make sure that they have appropriate infection control measures and stay in place. We've been redoubling our efforts to sensitize healthcare providers to how to correctly identify and deal with Ebola patients. As many of you may have seen, we issued a health alert network notice, which came out last night, which really lays out again all of the steps and all of the important things that healthcare providers need to know in order to correctly identify and safely deal with Ebola patients. One of the things that we're most focused on the ground now, and which you'll hear the details about from my Texas colleagues, is contact tracing. This is a key element in containing Ebola, and it means finding everyone who was exposed to the patient. As you know, once a patient becomes ill, it becomes possible for that person to infect others who came into close contact with him. What we do when we identify close contacts is these people may receive twice daily temperature checks. People are asked about symptoms and offered counseling and education. And we do this monitoring for 21 days, since that is the longest it can take for Ebola disease to appear after exposure. As we've mentioned previously, I think in the situation here in Dallas, there certainly is a possibility that some of the people who have already been in very close contact with this patient might develop Ebola, and that's why this close monitoring is so important. Before I turn this back to Barbara Reynolds, I just want to say a couple of other basic kinds of things about Ebola, some basic facts just so that we all have them in mind. The first is to remember that Ebola does not spread through the air. You can only get it by direct contact with a person who is sick with Ebola disease or from the body of a person who recently died of Ebola. That people who are infected with Ebola are not contagious until they become ill. And that hospitals who follow CDC's infection control recommendations can safely manage a patient with Ebola here in the United States. I think that with that, I'll close for now and turn this back over to Barbara Reynolds.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Next, we'll hear from Dr. David Lakey, who is the Commissioner of Texas Department of State Health Services. Dr. Lakey.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. We've had a very busy last 24 hours. trying to make sure that we everyone that has had potential exposure is identified and that they have been evaluated. And so a lot of work has taken place with a combination of a team of epidemiologists that consists of the CDC personnel, but also state epidemiologists and also the local health department epidemiologists working, again, as a team. They've been doing a lot of hard work to get our hands around the numbers. After the initial discussions with the hospital and with the patient, there were approximately 100 individuals that we needed to reach out to. That was the number that we put out yesterday. After reaching out to those individuals, there's now approximately 50 individuals that we need that we feel we need to follow on a daily basis. Now, most of those individuals are at low risk. There are about 10 individuals that are at higher risk, and so we continue to watch those individuals very carefully. So that's, again, the epidemiology that's been taking place at the hospital and in the community. Now, the individuals that we have concern about, those 50 individuals that need to be followed daily, every day a member of the public health team goes and visits those individuals. Each of those individuals has their temperature checked twice a day, and I want everyone to know that all those individuals are doing well. There's no additional individuals that have any symptoms that would be consistent with Ebola at this time. Now, having said that, again, we understand that we need to continue to watch them very closely, and that monitoring and that system to monitor those individuals have been put in place. With that, that's the end of my comments at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lakey. And our last speaker is Judge Clay Lewis Jenkins with Dallas County, Texas. Judge Jenkins.
Good afternoon. Well, we're in uncharted territory, but we've got a great partnership with the state and federal agencies that we're working closely with. We're in constant communication with the CDC and between them and us and our Dallas County Health and Human Services and Dr. Lakey's department, the Department of State Health Services. Dr. Lakey is here embedded with me in our IOC, or our EOC, rather, in our structure. The high-risk individuals in the healthcare field are furloughed without pay from work. They're not to travel outside the city. They have one in-person visit daily and one self-check. The low-risk individuals have no restrictions, can travel and have one daily phone call, check-in, and one self-check. There is a plan in place if individuals do not adhere to these guidelines. We have law enforcement go check on the individual to make sure they're okay if needed. All contacts are closely monitored, and there's a plan in place for any symptomatic children or adults. We'll get questions on this. I'll preemptively tell you it was my desire. We whiteboarded. The decision was made to move to an incident command structure on Wednesday, and that evening we whiteboarded the removal of soiled items, and we were unable to accomplish that due to some permitting issues yesterday. That is underway, as some of you may know if you're watching television. I did travel myself and went inside the apartment with two CDC epidemiologists last night to apologize to the family for the delay in getting those removed and to assure them that I want to see them treated as I would want my own family treated, and we are making efforts to make sure that their accommodations and their comfort improves. So with that, I'll turn it over.
And Judge, just one quick comment. I think some of us heard furlough without pay. It is furlough with pay.
I beg your pardon.
Just want to make a quick clarification that we're being very careful to make sure that this doesn't become an issue. And so, doing anything that we need to make sure we care for those healthcare workers. So it's furlough with pay.
Yeah, beg your pardon if I said without pay. We're moving from one meeting to the next meeting, and I'm just reading the stuff as we go.
Thank you, Judge Jenkins. Kelly, I think it's time for us to open up for questions.
Thank you. At this time, to remind the participants, if they do have any questions or comments, that is star followed by one on your touch tone phone, star two to remove that question. And our first question today comes from Lucy Scott from ABC News. Your line is open.
Thank you, doctors. Thank you, Judge Jenkins. What is the timeline for an FDA-approved Ebola vaccine, and are any experimental drugs being considered for Mr. Duncan?
Thank you. This is Dr. Bell. I can answer that. We've been working actually very closely across the U.S. government to really jumpstart and quickly move forward on vaccines. There are a couple of vaccines that are currently being investigated. The NIH has been doing what we call a phase one study where we evaluate the safety of the vaccines, and there's a second vaccine that's also being evaluated in that way. So we're working very hard to accelerate this, the evaluation, but of course we really need to be sure that the vaccines are safe and effective before they're used widely. But this is a very, very high priority for us, and we're working very hard in this area. In terms of the second question about the experimental treatment, we don't have any information about that, certainly from here, and I think in any case it would really be a decision between the patient and his family and their physician.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kelly, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Miriam Falco from CNN Medical News.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the questions. Why is the 50 contacts being more closely monitored? I think people will wonder, well, how did he get in contact with 50 people when he was sick enough to possibly be a threat? And also, I think, bigger picture, yesterday Dr. Frieden talked about how the health officials, health authorities have to work with the Department of Transportation because they're the ones who are in charge of hazardous waste transportation. And we noticed quickly yesterday that that hadn't happened yet. I think some folks might be losing confidence in how this is being managed. What other things need to be done or maybe are in place already? Are other hospitals, as a result of what happened in this past week, better prepared? Do you have that confidence? Or are we just now at the beginning of a better build-up to prevent situations like this from happening? Because theoretically, even the hospital itself said they had just had a meeting last week to go through an Ebola situation and that they were well prepared, and it turns out they weren't.
Thank you. So I think in terms of your first question about the contacts, as we've been saying all along, we've cast a wide net, and we have decided on a group of people where, we have a very low bar for deciding to follow patients. I think it is important to remember and recognize that we're not suggesting by this that all of these people, that we have a great deal of concern about all of these people, because the reality is that we have a low level of concern about the vast majority of these patients, people that we're following. But contact tracing really is the pivotal component for responding to Ebola cases, and we think that it's prudent to continue to check in with these people during the 21-day incubation period, just so that we know how we're doing, and we have as an early warning system, and we're just being extremely cautious and careful. But as I say, I think it is important to realize that this does not imply that we have a high level of concern about most of these people. With respect to the second question, we at CDC have been using many, many methods over many months to sensitize the medical community and to make sure that they understand all the different components of how we need to be prepared to respond to a case of Ebola here in the United States. And I think we do have some evidence that our work has had some impact. We have been in communication with in over 100 situations with hospitals around the country who have identified patients where they have questions about whether that person might be appropriate for testing for Ebola, and we have tested somewhere on the order of 15 or so people for Ebola, and it's this kind of back and forth and open communication that really, I think, does demonstrate that, in fact, what we have been doing has had an impact. Now, is it perfect? Obviously not. We never can be perfect. We strive for perfection, but what we're continuing to do is redouble our efforts to further spread the word, use this as a learning experience, and continue to strengthen our preparedness for imported Ebola cases.
If I could follow up, though, specifically, what kind of contacts are we talking about? And also, in this latest thing, are the Department of Transportation connections that needed to be made as announced yesterday, are they made now, or are they going to be in place? You know, is this going to be solved very soon, or is this something that's going to take a while? It just seems like there's a greater sense of urgency now.
Yeah, okay, thank you. So for the second question, it will be solved quite soon. The fact that it hasn't been solved right at this moment should not be taken to mean that there's some very large roadblock that we can't overcome. We're confident that it will be resolved. In terms of the first question, you know, as we've said, we were talking with potential contacts in the community and potential contacts in the hospital and in the healthcare environment. So that's where the contacts that we're talking about come from. Dr. Lakey, I don't know that we need to have say anything more specific about this, but if you'd like to chime in, this is your opportunity.
No, I'd be happy to. Just briefly, I think, again, seconding to what you just said, that you have people in the community, and then you have, you know, the ambulance team, and then you have the hospital team when the person came in. And so throw in a very broad net, and anyone that had potential contact, whether the patient is brought in through the hospital, you know, anybody that had, you know, there's the healthcare workers that directly see the individual, on that the first night on the Friday when he came in, anyone that was in the emergency room, if anybody had was drawing blood, or if anyone was processing blood, and how they were using personal protective equipment, you throw a very broad net out there so we can make sure that we don't miss anybody, or do everything we can to make sure that we don't miss an individual. And so that's that broad net, you know. Identifying the 100 with those conversations, is there anything that would put this individual at a potential risk? And when we've done that, we've gotten it down to 50. But again, most of those are low concern. The ones that are higher concern would be as approximately 10 individuals.
Okay, thank you. Next question, Kelly.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Maggie Dorr from CBS News. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Can you tell me if the patient who's being treated in Washington, D.C. at Howard University Hospital is a confirmed Ebola case?
No. The short answer is no. However, we are aware of this patient. We have been in contact with the hospital and the local public health authorities, and we will be assisting in doing the appropriate evaluation and diagnostic testing.
So since there have been several cases where people have been tested, 15 as you mentioned, can you tell us anything about the Howard University case, whether it rises to a level where further investigation is warranted?
Well, we don't know all the details yet, but we do have an algorithm, a way for hospitals and healthcare providers and the public health people to think about whether it makes sense to do Ebola testing and what evaluation is needed. So this is where, in this case, all this information is being collected, what the person's travel history is, what kind of exposures they might have had when they first became ill, some sense of the constellation of their symptoms and the general kind of trajectory of their symptoms, whether they have any other underlying medical conditions, all of these things. Then there, of course, are issues about what are some of the other conditions that can cause a fever and the rest of the symptoms we're talking about here. So things like malaria or Lassa fever or other kinds of conditions that can cause a very similar clinical presentation. So these are all the kinds of factors that we consider along with the public local public health people and providers when we're deciding about whether to do Ebola testing or not. Thank you. Next question, Kelly.
Thank you. Our next question comes from John Roberts with Fox News. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. Just going back to events over the last few days, you know, we hear public pronouncements from the CDC and from public health officials in the state of Texas day in and day out about how we've got this under control, we can contain it, don't worry. Yet when we take into account the combined ideas that this guy allegedly lied on his exit questionnaire and then so many balls were dropped by the hospital on the way in, what can you say to people to make them confident that the public health protocols are in place that will keep this nation as safe as possible from somebody who comes into this country or is preparing to leave West Africa infected with Ebola?
Well, first, I guess I'll say in terms of this particular situation, this particular case, that I think what you've been hearing is that we have done a lot of meticulous work over a very short period of time, and we've identified any of the people who might have had any sort of potential exposure, and we have a plan to follow them closely. I think that in a bigger picture kind of a way, the steps are really pretty clear, and we have multiple layers in place to help reduce the possibility of cases coming into the United States. Those layers involve actions that we take in the countries that are affected. There are actions that we take in the course of travel, and there are actions that we take here in the United States. And certainly when, and there's some very simple things involving finding cases, isolating the person, doing contact tracing, and isolating the contacts if they develop symptoms, which are, as I say, tried and true method for containing Ebola. You know, I'll just mention that we at the CDC have been dealing with Ebola and with Ebola outbreaks for over 40 years. And we do have quite a bit of experience about this, and I think we also do have a reasonable sense that it is about what it takes to transmit Ebola. And again, I think I just want to remind people that it really is a matter of direct contact, mm-hmm. something that we've seen over and over again over the course of 40 years.
Dr. Bell, I understand all that, and with respect, in this particular case, all of those layers failed, from leaving Monrovia, Liberia, to the first intake at the hospital, to trying to find a contractor to clean up this apartment, to getting the proper permits for hazardous waste removal. Every step along the way failed. So how can you reassure the public that you've got this under control?
The case has been identified. The case is being dealt with appropriately. The contacts are being traced and followed up appropriately. And so all of the necessary steps are being followed. Thank you. Kelly, next question, please.
All right, thank you. And our next question comes from Denise Grady from the New York Times. Your line is open.
Thank you. For the people that you have identified, the 10 that you say are high risk, and I'm assuming that these would include the family members who have been under quarantine, is there anything medically that could be done to help them in a way to sort of prepare them in case they do get sick? I realize that there's no cure for the disease itself, but is there anything that someone anticipating getting sick could do to maybe blunt the effects of the infection or to try to improve their chances of getting through it before the symptoms even set in?
Thank you. Unfortunately, there really isn't anything that can be done to sort of prevent Ebola from developing if, in fact, the infection has occurred. But, you know, I think there is a lot that can be done in terms of education of the folks that we're following, as you're saying, for example, the household contacts, so that they understand what are the symptoms that they should be looking for in addition to fever, and they also understand the importance of early medical attention. There really are a lot of things that can be done, just basic supportive care, that really do improve outcomes with Ebola. And so the sooner that a person who has symptoms that are consistent with Ebola gets medical care, the better. And so what we want to do is make sure that these people understand very clearly what are the symptoms that they need to be looking for and exactly what they need to do should they develop any.
Would they be taken to the same hospital?
Dr. Lakey?
We have had conversations with the hospital and have put in contingency plans on how we would care for any of these individuals if they become ill.
Thank you. Kelly, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Anna Kampoy from Wall Street Journal. Your line is open.
Hi. I wanted to know if there are any plans of taking the four individuals that have been ordered to stay at the apartment to another place, and why it took so long to get their apartment cleaned up.
This is Clay Jenkins, the Dallas County Judge. I've said I'd like to see them moved to a place that includes its own washer and dryer and is a more complete living arrangement than what they have right now. And we are working on that, but we have no plans to announce on this call. Why did it take so long to clean it up? Even as we speak now, we don't have the permits in place to dispose of the soiled items. And so there's a hazmat team. If you look on your television, you'll see them out there. They're cleaning the area. When I get off the call with you, I'll be changing into my Homeland Security gear and heading out that way to answer questions from people as our Dallas County crews under an order move that material, because I don't need a DOT permit to move material inside Dallas County to a secure location while we await those permits to move that to a permanent location and dispose of it properly. While it's being stored in a site that is away from the urban population, it will be in a sealed container, and it will be guarded by law enforcement. And I am, as I have said, I am concerned for this family. I want to see this family treated as my own as I would want to see my own family treated if I were incapacitated in a hospital. I don't like that there has been soiled items in their home with them. I was in the home last night. The items are bagged. They're in one bedroom with the door closed. The woman who you've now identified, who spoke to a reporter on the phone, is sleeping in the main room, and the young men are in the other bedroom. So that's about all I have for you on that right now.
Thank you, Kelly. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kelly Glimbloom from Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, stepping back, about the decision to keep those people in the apartment originally where the patient fell ill, and also whether they're getting any sort of psychological help. I mean, obviously there's an enormous amount of tension and stress going on right now for them.
Yeah, there's an enormous amount of tension and stress. They're understandably scared, and it's being heightened by all the scrutiny and the media scrutiny. Even as I visited with them yesterday, as I stood at their front door and knocked, an unannounced visit, unannounced to the media visit, at around 9 o'clock at night, the media, who's a block away, lit their front door up with lights. And took pictures.
Yeah, so,
and that is very frightening, you know, as is waiting in those conditions to be monitored. the CDC and the local Dallas County EPI teams that are going over there at training and are talking to them about social matters, not just taking their temperature. And there are other providers as well that are helping them through things. But again, I'd like to see the setting be a different setting.
Thank you, Kelly. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Sabrina Gibbons from Cox Radio Atlanta. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Dr. Bell a question, if you don't mind. Thank you for taking our calls today. We had talked about earlier the case in Washington that was not confirmed. Today we had a case here, a possible case in Cobb County, of someone who was stopped, pulled over, had a slight fever, was taken to the hospital to be checked out. I don't know if you've heard about this case, so you can say yes or no on that. And then how long does it take once somebody has a fever and thinks that they may have Ebola? Can you walk us through the process of testing and how long it takes and, you know, if it's locally done and then sent to you? Can you give us a time frame on that?
Yeah, okay, thank you. No, I don't know about the situation in Georgia that you just mentioned. So in terms of the lab testing, we have a system in place now, you know, where there are about 14 state public health laboratories around the country that have the capability for to test for Ebola, and this is something that actually was not in place before the Ebola outbreak started in West Africa, and it's been one of the things that we very rapidly put in place once we did develop this problem in West Africa so that we had distributed capability around the country to test for Ebola. In addition, of course, we have capability here in the United States to do regular testing and also to do more advanced and complicated confirmatory testing. So once a specimen is drawn from a patient, comes to the medical provider, they have a fever or other symptoms that are consistent with Ebola, and their history and other information makes this possible. Once the laboratory test is, once the blood is obtained, we usually get a test result back within 24 hours. Once we actually have it in the laboratory, it's actually very quick. It just takes a few hours. But, you know, between the time of transporting the specimen to the laboratory and stuff, there is a relatively fast turnaround. As I say, within a day, the people have their results.
Thank you. Kelly, next question, please.
One moment, please. Thank you. And our next question comes from Jeff Broomfield from National Public Radio. Your line is open.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could give us a breakdown of those 50 individuals. How many are hospital workers? How many are community members? How many are EMTs? And also, how do you know you're not missing anyone in this process?
Dr. Leahy?
Yeah, so this is David Leahy. You know, the last part of the question, how do you make sure they're being very careful, and you know, they take this extremely seriously. You throw out a very broad net. They interviewed the patient, interviewed the wife, interviewed contacts, who had been in and out of his apartment, who had contact with them to address the community side. You map the process for the when the individual came to the hospital, all healthcare workers that had potential contact with them. And healthcare workers being very, very broad, and so it's not only that the physician, it's, you know, triage nurses, you know, respiratory technicians, anybody that had contact with him, and it goes on then to the laboratory. It's checking, you know, how the blood was processed, who potentially could have had any exposure to the blood, and also look, you know, anybody that could have potentially been in. You know, another patient, were there any individuals that were potentially other patients? And good news about that was there weren't any additional other patients that had come to the hospital that were potentially in contact. So it's a very broad net. You know, there's been really, you know, for the ambulance, there's three individuals. and then the community, the community hospital breakdown. I don't think we're ready to put that out yet, but that total number, after we've talked to everybody, it's 50 individuals, and then of that, again, is a much smaller subset of 10 individuals that are at higher risk.
Can I just press you on that hospital number, because it seems important to me, given the way he was managed in the ER, to know how many hospital workers may have been exposed by him coming in and released.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think it's I appreciate your pressing. I think these are the numbers that we feel comfortable putting out right now. Of the 50 that are being followed in total, having that daily contact, and 10 being at the high risk.
All right, thank you. Can we have one more question, please, and then we'll finish up with last remarks.
All right, thank you. Then our last question then comes from Sherry Jacobson from Dallas Morning News. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. Well, since you said it was 24-hour turnaround, it would seem, on that blood test, can you tell us why it seemed to take more than 48 hours for this particular test to be confirmed? I would like to know when the CDC actually learned that Dallas had a potential Ebola case, and then given the rapid tests and all that, why it took so long for us to find out about it.
Sorry, but I'm not quite sure that I understand the point that you're making here. So could you maybe?
Yes. Our understanding was that the patient was put in isolation Sunday morning, so early Sunday until 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, when it was confirmed to the public. I'm just wondering when the CDC got involved. Was it that Sunday morning? And when the CDC got the blood sample so you could begin testing it?
Yeah. This is David Leike from the state of Texas. And so the individual came in on Sunday. There was concerns about Ebola, and there was conversations that were made in order that, one, are the risks really put him at risk of Ebola? And so making sure everyone was comfortable that he fit the criteria for testing. The epidemiologists were talking from the hospital, the local area in the state, to make sure that they felt comfortable that this was an individual and it had enough risk that needed to be tested. Work was done on Monday to make sure that blood was transferred safely. The labs were ready. Everyone was ready to do the test. The blood arrived at our laboratory at approximately 9 a.m. on the Tuesday morning, and at the same time was transferred to the CDC, and we had results that afternoon. And so there was an abundance of caution to make sure that the blood was transferred safely to both the CDC and the hospitals, and the CDC and the state laboratory, and that all the protocols were carefully followed to make sure that it was done appropriately.
Yeah. So it would seem it was 24 hours before you got the blood, and then another 24 hours until the test results came out?
The blood arrived at our laboratory in Austin at 9 in the morning, and we had test results out by 1:20 that afternoon.
And that would be Monday or Tuesday?
That was on Tuesday.
Okay. And so at CDC, we received the specimen Tuesday, we tested Tuesday, and actually we had a team on an airplane and on the ground in Dallas, Texas, by that evening.
Yeah, and this is Clay Jenkins. Let me say our health department and the hospital called the CDC immediately on Sunday.
Okay,
thank you. I'd like to turn it over now for closing remarks to Dr. Bell. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon. I think, the bottom line here is that the best way to protect Americans and the rest of the world is to stop the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And that's what we've been working on extremely intensively over a period of months and will continue to focus on. As we said before, it's unfortunately not outside the realm of possibility that we will have Ebola cases here in the United States. That's happened. We've taken the appropriate measures, and over the next period of time, we'll be monitoring these contacts very closely and continuing to work to sensitize healthcare providers and the American public about what needs to be done to rapidly identify and deal with Ebola, potential Ebola cases here in the United States. Thanks again.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Now, this concludes today's briefing on the Ebola first case diagnosed in the United States. For reporters who have additional questions, they're welcome to call CDC at 404-639-3286. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, that does conclude today's conference. You may all disconnect at this time.